Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, but a terrific one. It is the fantastic writer and best-selling author, Jack McCallum. He is a longtime Sports Illustrated writer. I think if you listen to this podcast, you probably would know that. And he is here to talk about his latest book, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and the Hidden History of Hoops. Crispus Attucks High School is a historical high school in that, in the sports realm, they won the Indiana State Championship in 1955 and 1956 that made them the first all-black team in the nation to win a state title. And the star of those two teams was the iconic NBA Hall of Famer, Oscar Robertson. Do want to note that had a little bit of audio issues on this one. So my conversation with Jack is going to be, at least on my side, it's going to be a little less clean in terms of the questions than it normally is. We'll get that fixed next week. But Jack was terrific. And we talked about what is a really, really fascinating book, as well as a little Sports Illustrated talk at the end, just given that both of us worked there. And obviously Jack was one of the most famous voices that the brand had. So Jack McCallum, the writer of The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and the Hidden History of Hoops, coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, but not only a former colleague, but one of the absolute great writers of his era, Jack McCallum. If you're a basketball fan, you certainly know that name. He's a best-selling author, a famed and former Sports Illustrated longtime writer and editor, and he is here today to promote his latest book, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and the Hidden History of Hoops. It's a pretty fascinating book. For those who are familiar with the movie Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks is a high school as part of that film, not obviously the Hoosiers team that that very famous film was depicted on, but Crispus Attucks is a character. And Jack McCallum has now, I think, wrote the definitive book on their story. And with that, I bring in Jack McCallum. Jack, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Honored to be here with such an esteemed now north of the border colleague. The one Jack, guy who said, "Go ahead. I'm coming out of here if this happens, and you move the hell out of there." So
the irony is, like, and just so people are very, very honestly aware, I did not move to Canada. I have no politics or no anything else. I got a job at Sportsnet. As it so happens, we fell in love with Toronto, and it's a great place. But I'm not. I was not one who jetted for the border at after a certain election.
I would go with that story. That
good story. Yeah,
that origin story of your residency in Canada is much. Much better than the job, but
I mean, listen, if you follow me on Twitter, I think you know, at least among certain politicians, how I feel about them. But hey, man, I'm a New Yorker, and I grew up in the 80s and 90s in New York, so you can't, you know, it is what it is. But Jack, I will say about Jack, an absolutely phenomenal colleague at SI. He was a scorecard editor, which I wrote for a little bit. He could not have been just a better person to work with. And again, this was a guy who had great acclaim and fame as a writer and then turned out to be an excellent editor as well. But he's here today to talk about his book and to promote his book. And I absolutely encourage you to buy it. Again, you can get this on Amazon. Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and The Hidden History of Hoops. The reviews have been phenomenal as well. So, Jack, you've written, I don't know how many books you've written, 10, 12, something to that effect. Do you know the exact number? Yeah, of course, you probably do.
I believe the number is 12. The number which I acknowledge could be different. I've written 12. I acknowledge 8, I would say. But you know, that's sort of facetious. But yes, the number is 12. A lot of which I wrote, Richard, after I left Sports Illustrated. I just kind of got lucky that when I left in 2009, that it was it turned out to be a good time to do several books. So I was really, really fortunate in that respect to have a career at SI and then be able to sustain it a little bit with books after I left.
Yeah, no, your timing on that was really, really good. So I want to ask you about this again. You know, Jack has written books about very prominent basketball figures that you have known. A very famous book about the Dream Team. Wrote about prostate cancer, I believe. So some sort of personal stuff. But this story, Jack, like there had to be, I would think, some kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Like something must have compelled you to ultimately dig into this, because this is not an easy book per se to research and then ultimately write. You're dealing with a subject that's, you know, almost 70 years ago. You're dealing with a city, Indianapolis, that I don't necessarily think you have any connection to other than this story at this point. So why were you compelled to write this book? What's the origin story of this writing for you?
Well, it was back in kind of the, whether we want to call it the COVID era or the George Floyd era, but I was, you know, like everybody else, I was locked inside and I had a knee replacement that I was rehabbing from. And one of my sons managed to cut off two of his fingers in a wood splitting. Right. This was all coming kind of at the same time. And I was just very, like a lot of people, angry and looking internal. And I was just looking for something to write. And I came upon this story, not the Crispus Attucks story. I came upon this story, and it's a chapter in the book, about Marion, Indiana, which is a small town, not a real small town, but that won the Indiana State Basketball Championship in 1926. I do not remember how I came upon this story. I think that I was researching, talk about a dark subject, the history of lynching.
Wow.
It just started, I don't know why, but there was just kind of dark period that I started, bought some books on it. Up comes the story of Marion, Indiana, this town where in 1926 they won the Indiana State Basketball Championship with this very famous team. You could still go to Marion and that's the team they talk about. So they celebrate in the town square, as small towns are wont to do. 4 years later, in that same Times Square, they have a lynching. They lynch two men. Actually, three were strung up. It's a long story of why the third was spared. But so I became kind of, and it was the picture that inspired Billie Holiday's song, "Strange Fruit," and. I just started becoming fascinated with that story. Why with these same people that were celebrating the bit, and supposedly everybody in the town came to the lynching in 1930. It was like, you know, a civic event. I mean, that's what lynchings were. I'm getting off the subject here, but they were a celebration of a town coming together to impose justice, and the whole sort of power of them came from this image of the men, usually men, hanging there afterward where you could cruise by and see them. Anyway, I said, well, this is a great book. But it wasn't for me. My son, my agent, a number of friends said, it's an ugly story. we don't need another white guy white-splaining lynching to America. It was just a little. I asked a couple African-American writers if they wanted to join me, all of whom are my friends. It wasn't like I came out of the air. All of them said, man, Jack, I can't do it, man. It's just too dark. And I don't know what else, you know, you say. I suppose I had a historian. I'm sure there is something to say. I just concluded I was not the one to say it. And during this research, I came upon the Crispus Attucks story, which actually started right around that same time because high school was opened in 1927. This period of time I'm talking about, 1926 was the state championship, 30 was the lynching. So there was this kind of perfect storm of things happening in Indianapolis, the domination of the Ku Klux Klan, whether or not they were violating laws by opening a segregated high school, which is what Crispus Attucks was. So I saw this as a story I could bring more to. And it turned out, obviously, look, man, I'm a basketball writer. That's what I've been. I might try to run from that a little bit. But if anybody wants to hear me talk, and they probably don't, it's probably got to have basketball in it. So this was the perfect story.
Okay, so what's sort of interesting to me, just in terms, because on this podcast, I do talk a lot about process. And so in order to do the book justice, which I think you did, you would have had to, at least, I think, probably travel to Indianapolis to whatever archival research exists. You probably, I imagine, wanted to walk around this high school, you know, just so you could see it with your own eyes and stuff like that. You have no connection to Indianapolis, but I think the book really does a great job in terms of like giving me a sense of like what the climate was like at the times, so right after the Supreme Court ordered desegregation of the schools. Ku Klux Klan is still very, very prominent in Indiana, massively so. And so what did you happen to make a lot of trips to Indianapolis, Jack? Like what was the research process of this again? Because you're a guy in Pennsylvania. It's not like you have any connection to this school or this city.
I think a lot of times, I think sometimes you're better off doing a book. My favorite book, I suppose my favorite book would be, my favorite book I wrote was about my season with the Phoenix Suns, simply because I had so much access. And it was like I was a fly on the wall of a member of a great team. My second favorite book you'd think would be Dream Team, because if anything was a commercial success, it was that. But my next favorite book is the book you mentioned I wrote about prostate cancer, because, yeah, it was my prostate cancer. But I didn't know shit about the science of prostate cancer. So I started out, you know, I interviewed every notable person in the prostate field at Johns Hopkins, at Northwestern, you know. So it was a lot of fun, sort of this fun of learning things. So for this book, normally, what I depend on is talking to people like the Dream Team book. The whole ball game with the Dream Team book, the whole ball game was getting the 12 guys to talk.
Right.
That's what I had to do. And people do not understand. You do. But people don't understand how difficult that is. Yep. You have to arrange interviews with 12 of the richest and busiest people on earth. You have to get them into an environment where they want to talk. And you have to draw something out of them. This book, I'm facing, a lot of the people have passed on. That's the word that they invariably use. Well, he's passed. You know, he's gone. They're 10 years older than me. I'm 74. They graduated from high school, 55, 56. A lot of them are dead. So I had to depend on a lot of textual material, books. So the interviews that I did, and we'll get to Oscar in a minute. The interviews I did with the people, the surviving teammates, a couple other people surrounding Crispus Attucks, were probably not the meat of the book, unlike with other books that I've done, because there weren't enough interviews to be done with people, you know, who are still alive. So this is how historians work all the time, right? You have an event. I mean, there's been 18,000 books on Abraham Lincoln. You know, nobody that I've ever read has been alive when Lincoln was. So you have to depend on textual material, old newspapers, old archives. And then finally, the key is finding a way to tell the story. How do you tell this story? And it was lucky, I'll talk about it, but for me, it came to me kind of right away.
Okay. Well, again, I should mention, if I didn't this at the top, that Crispus Attucks, their high school basketball team won the Indiana State Championship in 1955 and 1956. That made them the first all-black team in the nation to win a state title. And again, they won twice. And obviously their most famous player was Oscar Robertson. So I would think, Jack, just sort of logically, if nothing else, in terms of trying to maybe get the public's attention, you do have this Hall of Fame all-time player who was part of this high school that you could, if nothing else, right, like make the basketball sell. Like, I mean, Oscar Robertson is not Michael Jordan. He's not Kobe Bryant, but, you know, he's in whatever that next tier is of like sort of known famous all-time players.
Yeah, you had to find, you know, you always got to find somebody that wants to buy it. And I can't say I sat at a table with six publishers clamoring to do this. You have to find somebody who understands the weight of the story. And in my case, his name was Brant Rumble. He's an editor at Hachette Books. And Hachette is more inclined to do, let's see how I can phrase this, more of the smaller book that tells a bigger story. You know, I'm not James Patterson trying to sell something there. So, you know, I did have a number of publishers say, this is a regional story. It isn't. And I didn't realize the extent of that till I started researching. I did not sell it as, well, there's repercussions in modern America. I wasn't smart enough to do that. But as I started researching it, what became evident to me was the entire reason that Crispus Attucks was established by the Indianapolis School Board. They voted in 1922 to establishment was echoes, or not echoes, they're pre-echoes, pre-verbs, of the replacement theory. There were too many blacks coming into Indianapolis. They're taking over. They're flooding our great high schools. There's going to be mixed blood. They're bringing disease. We have to get them over to the west side of town where they have their own high school. And, you know, the subtle ways that blacks were kept down were just so many, you know, redlining, you know, real estate laws, you know, all kinds of reasons that kept that a very segregated place. The joke was on everybody else that Crispus Attucks became very successful for an interesting set of reasons.
Before we get to Oscar, I want to ask you sort of just one thing about the play. So when I knew I was going to have you on, I actually went back and watched some of their championship games. You actually watched the video of both titles, you know, title like Indiana State championship title game. It's probably called something else. I'll just use that. I actually went back to look at, it's always worth looking at the Milan game, which was 32-30. Bobby Plumps, obviously, famous shot. But the one thing I that's very clear, Jack, if you watch some highlights of that, holy cow, Oscar Robertson's ahead of everybody else. Like, he's playing a different game than literally every other person on the court. And what was cool to me, just as a basketball fan, is like you could sort of see what was coming, like with Oscar in that game, because he looked. I realize it's 55, so just bear with me for this. People are listening. He looks like he's playing a modern game where everybody else is not playing that same game. That's what I saw in the video. How did you see it?
No question. 4 years before Oscar got there, the best player, and probably remains the second best player in Crispus Attucks history, is a guy named Hallie Bryant. Hallie Bryant went on to play with the Harlem Globetrotters. He was the guy, you know, he could do all the Globetrotter stuff. His specialty just happened to become he was the guy that took the half court shot and, you know, that went in at least three quarters of the time. And this was like, you know, just before Steph Curry, you know. So anyway, and if you watch Hallie play, God, he probably won't watch this podcast, Richard, so I'm okay.
I doubt it.
He would be, excruciatingly angry at this, but Halle Bryant looks stuck in time. And the big way I always say it was that even skilled players dribbling to their left, right-handed players, would dribble with their right hand. You know, they wouldn't use the left hand. So Oscar comes along, and when he was his brother had played there, his brother Flap Robinson was called that for the way that he flapped his wrist after taking a jump shot. So Flap was one of a very famous Christmas Addicts player. But Oscar gets there as a sophomore, and according to what he's written about it, he's not necessarily going to be a starter. And from the beginning, his versatility almost worked against him. He was big. He was, you know, 6'2", 6'3", as a sophomore, but he loved to rebound. He loved to get down in the trenches. So what was he? Was he a forward? He loved to shoot. He loved to pass. He loved to dribble. So nobody exactly knew what his position was. And he was eventually listed, as was Jerry West, interestingly enough, by the way, as a forward, because you had the center who was the tallest guy, and you had the two guards who were the next smallest guys, and then the other two guys were the forwards. But Oscar, from the beginning, just sort of, there's a great quote from Ray Crow, his coach, African-American coach, who there's a lot about to say about him. But Ray, and Ray was dead, I didn't get to interview him, but Ray in numerous interviews said, Oscar, he just ran the game. You know, it was sort of like, and I thought that, you know, if they could somehow mythically get the top 20 players or the top 12 players out there in the court of all time, I don't care who's there, Jordan, Magic, Bird, LeBron, you know, whoever out there, Bill Russell, Oscar would go, well, I'm running this damn team. You know, that's all there is to it. I mean, that may not be the right decision I'd probably give the ball to Magic or LeBron, but that's what Oscar was as a player. And as you mentioned, the evolutionary leap that he put on this game during his years at Addicts really, really moved the game along at a time when it was not an African-American game. The African-American team that people knew was the Globetrotters. That's right. What they knew. There was this underground African-American game, you know, the New York Wrens and people like that. But Oscar, from that standpoint, was a truly a player that moved the game along.
Oscar Robertson is 85 years old now. So Jack, did you have some kind of sort of, I don't know if you had known him previously, but did you have what was sort of the game plan in terms of trying to sort of get his thoughts about this time, which obviously for Oscar at this point now is, you know, nearly 70 years ago.
Well, I don't want to bury the lead here. So Oscar, getting the conclusion, would not talk to me about the book. Okay. I had done a story before. Remember the old Sports Illustrated Where Are They Now issue? I had done one on Oscar. And part of the subtext of this book is Oscar's feeling. Oscar, somebody from Crispus Attucks told me, Oscar has a lot to be pissed off about, and he's pissed off. You know, he's not one of these guys that said, you know, everything is fine. I'm gonna forget the way that I grew up. I'm gonna forget the racism that I faced in Indianapolis. I'm gonna forget the racism I faced when I got drafted in Cincinnati. Oscar never forgot that. So there is a level of suspicion by the remaining people on this team about the Addicts story. This feeling that it's kind of been co-opted. Well, and Oscar, and there's this parallel resentment that's always there about the movie. That the fictional Hickory High School is 1,000 times better known than the actual real life Crispus Attucks. And right. certainly people like me over the years, I never wrote about the Crispus Attucks story, yet I've wrote a story about sports movies and how much I liked Hoosiers. And I know Angelo Pizzo, the writer, and I've invited him to talk in classes when I've, you know, talked about it. So you layer all that together, and there is this feeling that the story, that the white narrative has very much overtaken the black narrative. That's just a fact. And the Attucks players who talked to me finally were willing to get by that. And I mean, they didn't know who, I mean, they, one of them might have known my name from Sports Illustrated, but to Oscar, you know, I made probably 10 entreaties. And finally, he just said, good luck with your project. I'm not going to be a part of it, which is a pattern of Oscar and many other things in his life. And what you have to do as a writer is try to weigh that. You know, this is America. If Oscar Robertson doesn't want to talk to me, he should be able to make that decision.
Right.
And in many ways, as a writer, it frees you up a little bit, because one thing I didn't want to do, Richard, I didn't want this to be a biography of Oscar Robertson. Yeah. And if Oscar talked to me for 25 hours and everything is filtered through Oscar, then it is an Oscar Robertson biography. So maybe it's part rationalization, but in the end, I was glad that I had to kind of write around Oscar and have him sort of silently guide the book rather than being the main voice in it.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty thoughtful explanation. And where I do agree with Oscar Robertson on for sure is that the Crispus, as great a movie as Hoosiers is, and it's an all-time sports movie, the Crispus Attucks story is far more interesting and far more layered, because to me it speaks far more to America than Hoosiers did.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right, a couple more here, and then I'm going to let you go, Jack. I want to ask you about something current in the NBA because of you interviewed Greg Popovich many times and you are certainly familiar with him, and you know, you watch the Robinson, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Ginobili Spurs, etc. And now Victor Wembanyama is on the Spurs, and it's not overstating that he is a very different player than anything we've ever seen. You know, you were fortunate enough to cover Jordan, who obviously clearly changed the game. And, you know, you covered so many of these great stars, the Barkleys and, you know, Clyde Drexlers, et cetera. But I wanted to get your perspective on this guy, because as a longtime basketball writer, like this guy to you is unique, correct? You have, I would imagine, like me, you have never seen anyone with at that size with that kind of skill.
Oh, you know, no doubt about it. The guy that wanted to be Victor Wembanyama was Ralph Sampson.
Yeah.
He desperately in the 80s, and I knew Ralph from the beginning. I just happened to do a couple college stories on him and always found him fascinating. And people don't understand, when you talk to Ralph, he just unfolded in front of you. He was a gigantic man and had the basketball sort of trendsetters been able to envision. I think Ralph, everybody was always telling Ralph, I mean, this is a little bit, oversimplified, get under the basket.
Right.
You're too big. You can't be doing this. Not only you can't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing this. So the world, I've always felt Ralph was a little bit, underrated and undervalued, because I don't think anybody understood what he could do.
Born before his time too, right? I mean, if this guy was Wembanyama's age, we'd be talking about him as a revolutionary figure. Figure out an offense to work around this guy.
No question. And, he got on, now we're getting off on Ralph rather than Wemby, but, when he went to this team, and I love Bill Fitch was one of the most interesting characters I ever covered, but Bill was an ex-Marine and he has Akeem also. So right. He has this kind of graceful ballet, pivot guy who's an immortal player himself. Well, who do you think he liked better? he liked Akeem, Ralph, and they never, they just butted like this. Anyway, Wembanyama's now coming in, has come into a league where Steph Curry has, and others like him, but mostly Steph, has changed everything about the game. And I became kind of fascinated with whether somebody's a evolutionary player or a revolutionary player. And Curry is a revolutionary player. I mean, he widened that court to the point, the next time that Shaq defends a pick and roll will be the first time he ever did it. Now you got to get out, you got to get out on the court. It changed everything. So I think there is a chance with Wembanyama's size and the way he can do things as a big man, and the fact that Pop has apparently said, hey, man, let him play. Let him find his way, I think we're going to see, it's possible, a real change with the type of big man. I mean, from that standpoint, Nowitzki, to me, was a pretty evolutionary player. I mean, he pushed. I don't think he changed quite enough because he was a mid-range shooter. But this idea of the 7-footer coming in and, he's basically a shooter. We got 7-foot shooter. It's going to be different. It's really going to be interesting to watch this kid. I mean, he really is something that we haven't seen. I watch it once in a while and I went and I got to go back and I got to go, wait, did he just get from here? Did he just get from here to there? Without us, without being a travel, and his footwork and the way he handles himself as a finesse guy, he's really something else.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. You're right about Nowitzki. It's a really good observation. Porzingis actually owes a lot to Nowitzki because while he's not as good, it's sort of a similar kind of player and has given him, a great place in the league and riches and spacing out the floor, sure.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
All right, last one for me, and it's this one. Two of our fellow colleagues, Adam Duerson and John Walters, are writing a book on Sports Illustrated, an upcoming book. I'm not sure when it's publishing, but I imagine it'll be out in the next 2 years. I guess in some ways it's sort of a sequel to the franchise, the Michael McCambridge book, which was book about the history of SI. I have not read that book in a long time, Jack, but I'm going to take a guess and say you were quoted in there, or you're part of that book. You know, both of us obviously have seen what's happened to Sports Illustrated, and it's very depressing and it bums both of us out. But I wanted to ask you this actually from a book author perspective. And that is, like, I will obviously read the Adam Duerson, John Walters book for sure. But when you look at it commercially, how would you see that book commercially? Do you think that, like an oral history of the late stage SI, is commercial? And if yes, why? If no, why?
Wow, you're asking me to bury the Adam and John project before.
Or I'm asking you to praise it. I'm not necessarily saying.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I don't know. You know, you never know with, you know, you really never know with books. First of all, I really, just to escape the main question for a minute, I really love oral histories. I think that's a great way to do it. Two of the best books I ever read were about Second City, an oral history of Second City, and then John Abrams' book on The Wire.
Awesome.
Because you have this vast topic. You know, how do you attack it? Like I got back to, how do you tell this story? And how would you tell kind of that story? So I will say Adam and John's approach of the oral history, and they haven't called me yet, and I don't know what I'll say when, if they do call me, but it's sort of a way to do it because the story of SI is kind of, in recent days, is this complicated business story that Forbes magazine business writer even went, I can't figure this damn thing out, you know? So the business repercussions of this are too boring to be a sell. And I would say if it's going to succeed, I don't think a book is going to succeed that dissects for the American public what happened to SI business-wise. I don't think that is strong enough. Sports Illustrated was this brand that elicited, I hate to use that word, I just did, elicited every reason we go to sports. All these things that were written about SI when these stories came out were, my God, I used to run to my mailbox on Thursday. Wait, I remember the Gretzky cover. I remember I was a kid 11 years old in love with Michael Jordan, and I remember those covers. That is what SI always sold. So I don't think SI is powerful enough for a book to succeed about its undoing. I think the best book about SI, and I sound like an old Homer here and somebody, nobody would know my name if I didn't work at SI. I owe everything to that place. So let's put that into the equation. But I think it exists in kind of a warm place in people's memories. And you went to it for the entire reason that you loved sports. So if the book can somehow celebrate that, along with, of course, it's going to have to talk about the undoing, I suppose it can be successful. How's that?
That's very, very diplomatically said. I happen to think that if they take, and I think they will, by the way, knowing those guys a little bit, I think if they take the approach of both celebratory and then obviously to sort of detail what happened in the last, 5-7 years, I'm with you. And some of that will be like, and I'm sure they'll do this. Like you have to talk to some of the athletes whose lives changed from being on the cover or profile. Like, again, I don't think it would be easy, but one of my first sort of main goals, if I was Adam Duerson and John Walters, would be to get LeBron James. Like that, LeBron James's career is so identifiable with Sports Illustrated. And interestingly enough, obviously the contrast to Jordan, who once upon a time said, I'm never, was basically Sports Illustrated's most famous cover subject and said, I'm not ever going to talk to you guys again after that ridiculous cover. But LeBron, Jack, to me, I'm sure you agree with me. I mean, the magazine is a historical artifact because he was on the magazine cover at 17. Like that was his national coming out party, that cover. And then obviously we see what kind of pro basketball player he's become. So I'm with you. And I would hope, and I'm sure, I would imagine that they're going to do that. I think if you mix like getting LeBron and how much it meant to him and that's importance and Tom Brady, same kind of thing, with like the late stage sort of destruction of it, then I think you could have a great book.
Finally pivoting to that, Alex Wolff and I think Mark Moravec are doing a book of Grant Wall's columns.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
And Alex told me that, and I'm sure this is going to be, he will tell everybody else, and he should. They sent out this thing about the meaning of, you know, Grant Wall and what he meant, his stories and everything. And it was Grant's story, not soccer, but Grant's arguably most famous story is writing the LeBron story, like you said, right, when he was 17 years old.
Not arguably. It is the most famous story he did. Yeah, he would have told you that.
The first person to get back to them was LeBron James.
Wow, awesome.
So that's amazing. And, you know, you brought up Michael. When we named Michael Sportsman of the Year in 91, Michael had already kind of begun his alienation tour, not with SI, but he was getting pissed off. He wasn't pissed off at me, but there were these snipings, gambling, all this stuff was going on with Michael. And I went out there with John Papanek. It was during John's stint to tell Michael that he was Sportsman of the Year and kind of keep it quiet. And we went to a practice at the Bulls thing. He was like overwhelmed, you know, he was like, oh my God, you know, like a kid getting the most valuable freshman basketball player award, you know, that always, and this was not in the beginning of his career. This is 7-8 years into his career. And so you're right. It's going to have to hit those notes too. And getting the athletes to talk about it, you know, you just hope that somebody didn't buy the book or doesn't buy the book for the sensational reason that, oh, well, this is the archetype for what happened to modern journalism, that everything that has cratered in journalism, internet interfering, short attention spans, advertising going down, all these reasons that we have, which are legit, I hope that it's not bought for kind of that reason, because Sports Illustrated had too much of an important role in as a brand in our society.
Yeah, that's well said. I think those guys will do it right. By the way, as we wrap up, Jack, if I'm remembering my SI history correct, that 1991 Sportsman of the Year with Michael Jordan that you wrote the cover story, that is the hologram Michael Jordan on the cover, right?
That is the hologram. That was it was John Papanek's idea. And I remember he said, we're going to do a hologram. And I went, wow, what the hell is that exactly? but it was, it's funny. I got the Sports Illustrated stacked up there. And if ever looking back for them, I can always pick that out because that's the one that kind of shines out from the bookcase. So look at that. I mean, we're talking about that from, 30 years ago,
33 years ago. Yep.
Yeah, you kind of remember that. And so the power of SI was just, sort of remains, even if the business model does not.
It does. I obviously as someone who worked there and has great fondness for it, I'll on Twitter, very, very often, like I'll tweet a cover that sort of appeared on that day.
And I love how you do that, by the way. That's so great. I don't know do you get any response to that or?
Yeah. My point is I get a phenomenal response. And so I'll tell you this like really quick. Like, so this week I tweeted out, it was fairly recent from like whatever, maybe 16 years ago, something like that. JJ Redick and Adam Morrison on the cover. Like, who's the best?
Like, I saw that.
That thing is blown up. I have like 200,000 like views of it. And it tells you about the power of that cover, even at that late date. You know, these are guys who played late 90s, early 2000s. It mattered to people. So it's again, I don't know what's gonna happen to it. They're in a, like Jack said, just a miserable business sort of like pissing contest. But what it tells you, even through like something as dopey as Twitter, is it still has meaning, Jack. Like that cover still means something to people, even if it means nostalgia, but it means something.
Exactly. During the pandemic, when I would need a replacement, what I was going through, I would tweet out I would find old stories and giving, not my stories. In fact, they were never my stories. Give a little background on a Scott Price story or a Gary Smith story or something. And the response to that was just, you know, I never blow up on Twitter, was just amazing. You know, people coming back and saying what they remember about it. And again, yes, it is nostalgia. But let's face it, that's got a lot to do with the power of sports. There's no question about it.
Jack McCallum is the author of The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and the Hidden History of Hoops. Again, this is about a very, very famous high school basketball team in Indianapolis. They won the Indiana State Championship in 1955 and 1956, and they were the first all-black team in the nation to win a state title. That book is available now on Amazon and Goodreads and independent bookstores and big bookstores. Go support Jack there and buy that book. But it's really, really interesting. It's not, it's quite frankly not a basketball book. It's, to me, it's a sociological and culture book about where America was at that time, and then how this all black team, all black high school, related to that. Jack, I can't thank you enough for the insight. I wish you the best of luck with the book. We will obviously stay in touch, and thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
It was a lot of fun, Richard. Thank you.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Jack McCallum for his insight and time. Head to the archives if you like these kind of conversations. Please leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. Recently had Julie Kliegman on her book about the nexus of mental health and elite athletes. Andrew Marchand, my colleague at The Athletic, was on this podcast on March 4th. We went 96 minutes on sports nerddom. Jason Kirk was on this podcast to talk about his new novel, Peter King. Recently retired Sue Bird, Alex Sherman of CNBC, Kenny Smith, Noah Eagle. Again, should be some conversations that you'll appreciate and like. Want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thank you to everybody at Odyssey for their support. And most of all, thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.